Number four may or may not be harder for you. I can't quite predict, but I certainly have some clients for whom number four is the toughest. And number four is to discuss your achievements with humility, or as I sometimes put it, give away the credit for everything you do that your critics are glad to see you do. Let me start this one by telling you about my typical consultation. I will come into a client's office, and the client will say to me, "We're going to do X." And I'll look at the situation, and I'll say, "Gee, I think you should do Y." And the client will say, "No, we've always done X before. X is cheaper. We're going to do X." And I'll say, "I don't think X is cheaper anymore. You've got this stakeholder who really wants you to do Y. You've got that stakeholder who really wants you to do Y. I think if you re-examine your business in the new higher outrage environment that you're now doing business in, you're going to find that Y is actually better business than X." And I'll talk them into it. And they will decide for the first time ever in their corporate history to do Y instead of X. And then they issue their announcement. And the announcement begins, "In keeping with our long-standing corporate commitment to Y." What long-standing corporate commitment to Y? They've never done Y before. They don't want to do Y now. You know, we were up until midnight arguing about it. They're only doing it under pressure. They're doing it because their social license to operate is endangered. I know Rio Tinto uses the term social license to operate, or at least you used to. Do you still? Okay. I have some clients that use that term so frequently they have made it into an acronym. They talk about their slutto, you know. And I think the word captures how they actually feel about it. Our slutto is endangered. They are doing it to protect their... I hope... I'm not trying to introduce that acronym, by the way. Don't feel like, you know, you should take that on board. But they're doing it to protect their social license to operate. But a lot of companies believe that the consolation prize, when you're doing something under pressure that you don't want to do, is you get to pretend you wanted to do it. Now, there is nothing unethical about lying about your motives. Lying about your behavior is unethical. Lying about your motives is childish. What it's like, I think, is when you make your six-year-old clean her room. She doesn't want to clean her room, but you force her to clean her room, so she does. And there she is, standing in her room, her fists clenched, tears running down her cheek, saying, "I'm not cleaning my room because you made me. I'm cleaning my room because I want to." Yeah. And you say, "Yes, sweetheart, that's fine. As long as you clean your room. If you want to salve your ego by pretending that you want to, Daddy and Mommy don't mind." Okay. The problem is, we don't know whether Rio Tinto is cleaning its room or not. But we know you don't want to. So when you say you're cleaning your room because you want to, we rationally, parsimoniously conclude that you're not cleaning your room at all. That is, when you lie about your motives, which isn't unethical, you give the impression of lying about your behavior, which is. So let's look at two different plant managements, both of which claim that they have stopped polluting the stream. Okay. Management A says, "We stopped polluting the stream because we love fish more than profit." Management B says, "We stopped polluting the stream. Let me tell you why. First of all, the lawyers told us if we didn't stop, we were going to get sued by people downstream. Second of all, the NGOs told us if we didn't stop, they were going to show up at our next shareholders meeting and torture us. Third, the regulators told us if we didn't stop, they were going to pull our permit. They were going to take away our permit. Fourth, and most important, our friends, our families, our employees, our neighbors told us that values were changing, that if we wanted to be the kind of company people were willing to live near and work for and marry into, we were going to have to stop polluting the stream. So we did. not because we love fish more than profit, but because you're not allowed to earn a profit anymore unless you protect the fish. All right, here's the $64 question. Which of those two plants will people believe actually stopped polluting the stream? The second one. Now, they both stopped for the second one's reasons. But the first one, when it lies about its reasons, undermines the credibility of the behavior itself. One of the no-no words here, if you buy this principle, one of the words I would try to train you out of is voluntary. What does voluntary mean? Not looking for a subtle connotation. What's the dictionary definition of voluntary? You don't have to do it, right? You want to do it. You're doing it because you want to, not because you have to. So now, why would any company think that its stakeholders would be pleased if the company announced, "We have voluntarily decided not to kill you"? What that means is we're allowed to kill you, but we're not in the mood. If we decide to kill you next year, we'll kill you because it's up to us. But at the moment, we don't feel like killing you. So, I mean, I thought you weren't allowed to kill me. You know, I thought there were regulations that forbade you to kill me. And when you tell me you are voluntarily not killing me, you are explicitly telling me that there's nothing between me and death but your goodwill. Okay? Your goodwill is not that reliable. I don't want to think that you're not killing me because you don't feel like it. I want to think that you're not allowed to kill me. Now, if you think you're over-regulated, okay, then this is an idiotic thing to do. If you think you're under-regulated, if you think that more regulations would be a good idea, then saying you're doing things voluntary will help, because it certainly communicates to the public that you're under-regulated. Every time you say something is voluntary that I think you damn well ought to have to do, you're telling me that you need more regulations. If that's your purpose, you're accomplishing it. If that's not your purpose, why on earth would you keep saying things are voluntary? I mean, if you in fact think you are well-regulated. Now, I understand that technically much of what you do is voluntary, even if it's under threat of regulation or under threat of stakeholder anger or under threat of activists or traditional owners or, you know, employees, anybody torturing you, that you make voluntary decisions for business reasons that are voluntary only in the very limited sense that, you know, your boss may say, you have until Tuesday to retire or I'm going to fire you. When you quit, it's voluntary. But it's voluntary under pressure. I worked with the gold mining industry when they adopted the cyanide code, and that was a voluntary code. But why did the gold mining industry adopt a voluntary cyanide code? Yeah, well, I mean, they killed swans. They had a number of big accidents on several different continents. Cyanide became extremely controversial. And what was going to happen if they didn't adopt a voluntary cyanide code? There was going to be very strong regulation. Cyanide might be outlawed entirely in gold mining. They got together in Davos. At the World Economic Forum, all the CEOs of all the mining companies, including Rio Tinto, and they said, we better do this voluntarily before they make us do it, because we can probably get away with a little bit less draconian regulations if we impose them on ourselves than if we wait for governments to impose them on us. So it was voluntary, but only in a very limited sense. And I have no trouble with the word if you explain it that way. I have no trouble with you saying, we see the handwriting on the wall. You know, this group and this group and this group and this group are all putting pressure on us to do it. And we decided we better move voluntarily before that pressure becomes unmerciful. That's all right. As long as you explain it as something other than your saintliness, as long as you explain it as a response to pressure rather than an example of how deeply you care about our welfare. Okay. Another word that, or another term that I recommend against, and this one is going to be even more painful than the recommendation against voluntary, I do not like the term corporate social responsibility. Okay. I think it's crap. Now, I'm all in favor of corporate social responsiveness. Same initials. You don't have to re-embroider the towels. Okay. But what's the difference between being a responsive company and being a responsible company? What's the difference? Who sets the agenda? Exactly right. Responsible means you do what you think is right. Responsive means you do what your stakeholders think is right, that you are listening to, attending to your stakeholders. You have noticed that if you give your stakeholders what they want, you prosper, and if you deny your stakeholders what you want, what they want, you suffer, and you have therefore decided as a business decision to give your stakeholders what they want whenever you can, to be as responsive as you can. Now, we went through a period of corporate social responsibility hundreds of years ago with the Dutch East India Company, for example. We had corporations that did what they thought was best for the world, and we didn't like it. Okay. And the deal we make now with corporations is limited liability in return for responsiveness. You do what we think is best for the world, and we will reward you with limited liability and with profitability. Okay. So, and you do it fine. I'm not saying, you know, you don't do it fine. It's just that you lie about it. Okay. Or at least you mislead about it. So let me ask you, which is Rio Tinto, and for that matter, which are all companies actually? Responsive or responsible? Do you do what you think is best, or do you do what your stakeholders think is best? Responsive. Okay. And which does the public want you to be? Responsive. Okay. So there's no conflict between what you are and what we want you to be, and yet you persist in claiming to be something you're not and that we don't especially want you to be. Okay. That is, claiming to be doing it because you think it's good for the world instead of because we think it's good for the world. Every time you just do something that people want you to do, you get to decide who to give the credit to. You can give the credit to the NGOs, you can give the credit to the regulators, you can give it to the traditional owners, you can give it to your neighbors, you can give it to your employees, you know, you can give it to anyone you want, or you can take it yourself. And when you, when you take it yourself, it seems to me you are pissing it away. When you take it yourself, when you take the credit yourself, you are wasting it. Okay? You are undermining the credibility of the behavior itself. I want to take this a couple of steps further. Okay. Does everybody understand that if, in fact, Rio Tinto as a corporation actually does love fish more than profit, it's malfeasant? Does everybody understand that? This is not some cowboy capitalism idea from the U.S. This is fundamental capitalism everywhere in the world, and certainly including Australia. You have no right to love fish more than profit. You have a fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders to maximize long-term sustainable profitability. And you are not entitled to piss away shareholder value by protecting fish more than is conducive to the long-term value of the corporation that they own. You have no more right to protect fish more than is useful than you have a right, not useful to the fish, useful to shareholders, than you have a right to contribute corporate money to abortion rights or to right to life or to capital punishment or to stop capital punishment or to any other cause that you may be attracted to. It's not your money. It's your shareholders' money. And the only thing you can spend your shareholders' money on are things that help nurture the profitability of the corporation. That doesn't mean you ignore fish, because it's not profitable to ignore fish. If you ignore fish, profits go down in a bunch of ways. You know, regulators get angry at you and start throwing the book at you. Activists get angry at you and choose you instead of somebody else to go after. There are all kinds of good reasons for protecting fish, but loving fish more than profit is an illegal reason for protecting fish. Does everybody agree? Okay. So when companies claim to love fish more than profit, and Rio Tinto makes that kind of claim pretty frequently, you know, you pretty frequently say we care deeply about X and Y and that's why we're doing it, without linking those statements to the profitability of the company at all. Okay. When you make such claims. When companies claim to love fish more than profit, the only reason they're not sued by their shareholders is we all know they're lying. Okay? If we thought for a moment they were telling the truth, you know, you would be vulnerable to a shareholder lawsuit for misuse of funds. You'd also be vulnerable to a takeover. Of course, you were vulnerable to a takeover, but not for that reason. You'd also be vulnerable to a takeover attempt, grounded in the argument that you are wasting shareholder value on things that are not demonstrably useful to the long-term profitability of the company. So what happens? You in fact don't love fish more than profit. I'm not accusing you of loving fish more than profit. You don't love fish more than profit. What you do is exactly what you're supposed to do. You protect the fish as much as is profitable. Okay? You watch the zeitgeist. You watch the society. You watch the activists. You watch your neighbors. You watch the regulators. You watch all the stakeholders that have an impact on your profitability. And you see how much fish protection they are rewarding. And then you stick a time element on there because it's cheaper to provide as much fish protection as we will soon demand than to be always lagging behind. So you extrapolate the curve and you try to estimate how much fish protection will soon be required, and you give us just-in-time fish protection. Okay, and you do it fine. The only problem is you lie about it. And you pretend that you're protecting the fish because you care about fish, instead of acknowledging that you're protecting the fish because we, your stakeholders, care about fish. Okay. Now, what happens as a result of that lie? We don't believe you. If we believed you, we'd sue you. We don't believe you. But the cumulative effect, thousands of companies claim to love fish more than profit. In each individual case, we know they're lying. Okay. But the cumulative effect is the society begins to believe that companies should love fish more than profit. Okay. That belief leads us to stop rewarding you for protecting the fish, because you keep telling us you're not doing it for reward. You're doing it because you love the fish. So, you know, we sort of halfway call your bluff and halfway believe you, and we say, all right, you ought to love fish more than profit. It shouldn't require profitability to make you protect fish. You should do it out of love. So we stop rewarding you for protecting the fish. You notice and you stop protecting the fish. We notice and we get outraged and punish you, and you get a devolution that is bad for corporations, bad for profit, and bad for fish. And for the system to work right, everybody's got to know their job. Our job is to decide how much fish protection we want and reward and rig the payoff matrix so that much fish protection is rewarded, so that if you get it right, you get maximum profitability. Your job is to notice what the payoff matrix is and adhere to it in order to maximize profitability. You do your job, but because you mislead us about what your job is, we are no longer always doing our job. And that, in my judgment, is very dangerous. I'm a serious believer in capitalism. Some of you may not be. But I am a serious believer in capitalism, in regulated capitalism, regulated by outrage, regulated by accountability, regulated by responsiveness, not only regulated by regulations. And regulated capitalism only works if all us regulators understand our job. And when you mislead us about our job, you undermine capitalism. It is particularly bad, in my judgment, in the mining industry. Okay. It seems to me I think the mining industry, more than any other industry, has made huge leaps forward in environmental protection and in social justice. Huge leaps forward. You went from being a dinosaur industry to being a shockingly progressive industry in many ways. You definitely win the most improved camper award. Okay? But you don't get much credit for that progress. And at least one major reason why you don't get much credit for that progress is because you interpret that progress, you explain that progress to us as attributable to your saintliness rather than to your responsiveness. So the two things the mining industry routinely says about all the progress you have made, sometimes you say, no, that's not progress. We were always wonderful. And sometimes what you say is, we had a conversion experience on the road to Damascus. We were evil, but we have seen the evil of our ways, and now we're saintly. What you very rarely as an industry say to us is, the society kept handing you your hat, you kept losing more and more and more and more, it looked like we were going to get put out of business, and eventually you got smart and realized that you're going to have to be more responsive with regard to social justice and with regard to environmental protection, or you were in deep trouble. I'm going to take Jody's comment first because I have to live with her, and then yours.
That's not why I was taking it first. I agree with him about the dinosaur aspect of the mining industry and the great leaps forward that we've seen just over the time that we've been working with the mining industry. But I actually think that the pharmaceutical industry is much worse than the mining industry in terms of claiming a corporate social responsibility. The pharmaceutical industry has basically convinced the public that the pharmaceutical industry should do everything only for the sake of the public and not for profitability, which is really damaging the sense of capitalism. But they have other problems, but I think they're worse than the mining industry in terms of damaging capitalism by portraying themselves as corporately socially responsible.
I agree. They're a different part of the curve. I mean, they are an industry that does relatively little harm and is hated anyway because they claim to be saints. We're not really the pharmaceutical industry at all. We're some kind of health philanthropy. And we hold them to their claims. They can't live up to their claims, so we hate them. It's a little bit different for you because you do a lot of harm. Okay, so for them, it's about claiming to be saints, and therefore even we hate them even though they're not doing harm. For you, it's we have failed to notice that you have worked awfully hard to ameliorate the harm and made considerable success in the direction of ameliorating the harm, and we are not able to see that because you are not giving us a credible reason why it's true. The credible reason, which is the real reason, is we made you do it. We beat you fair and square. Okay, and what you need to do is tell us that. Yes?
Just picking up on those points, so when you're talking about the mining industry as an industry, or the pharmaceutical industry as an industry, there are going to always be points where individual companies have got shareholder value that establishes them as a point of difference to competitors. So, okay, you're saying that you can't be saintly about it, but obviously there needs to be a way of demonstrating that point of difference, why you're better in.
Yeah, I mean, let me see if I caught what you're saying, and if I do, if I understand it right, I have a reaction. I think what you're saying is there are these competitions, the reputation of whole industries is at stake, but also the reputation of companies within an industry where there is a competitive advantage to be had by being seen as, less rapacious than other mining companies. So that, if people are going to decide, should I do business with Rio Tinto or with BHP Billiton, you would like me to think that Rio Tinto, is more responsive, so I'm more interested in working with you and you want that competitive advantage. Do I capture your comment? Yeah, I think it's true and it's not true. You have much to be gained from a competitive advantage and you have even more to be gained from the whole industry improving. I'd like to see you doing both. I mean, I want to see you competing on the basis of social responsiveness. Notice, not social responsibility, but social responsiveness. And I also want to see you cooperating in industry-wide efforts to both make that reality more true and to make that messaging more straightforward because you are hoist on the same petard. Inevitably, every time, look what's happened to the whole oil industry because BP had a spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Similarly, if any time there's a disaster or a huge controversy, whether it involves your company or not, it damages your company. So yes, by all means, compete on that basis, but also cooperate on that basis. Other comments? Okay. So far, I've identified three reasons for giving away the credit, for saying you did the right thing because we made you rather than because you want to. The first reason is it's true, okay, and truth is always useful. The second reason is because it makes the behavior credible. I can believe you did it if you say you did it under pressure, because you did. If you say you did it because you're a saintly organization, I have trouble believing it. I have trouble believing that, you know, you guys are actually a philanthropy that just happens to own mines. You know, I think you're a mining company. And the third reason, and the most fundamental reason, is because it nurtures capitalism. If you want capitalism to survive, you need a public that understands how it works. And systematically misleading us about how it works is very bad for the future, not just of your company and your industry, but for all of us. There's a fourth reason that's much less theoretical than the third reason, and that is this. When you take the credit for things that other people made you do, you really piss off the people who made you do it. And that's an entirely unnecessary level of outrage. So, for example, I worked with a company that manufactured pacemakers and had a recall. I mean, you think you have problems. Think about a pacemaker recall. That makes you... That hurts. And as a result of the recall, the regulator that regulated this company, that regulated their industry, paid a surprise inspection visit to their manufacturing plant and found a few small but real quality control problems. So the company and the regulator negotiated a consent decree under which the company agreed that it would stop manufacturing, it would sell from stock, and it would take about 6 weeks to re-engineer its manufacturing so that when it reopened 6 weeks later, it would have leapfrogged over the competition, so we get a little bit of competitiveness in here, and it would have, instead of substandard quality control, state-of-the-art quality control. Now, most of you probably know a consent decree is not an enforcement action. A consent decree is technically voluntary. Okay, and taking advantage of that technicality, the company issued statements in which it said things like this. We have decided at our company that we want to have the very best quality control in our industry. We have therefore voluntarily decided to shut down our manufacturing plant and sell from stock. And when we reopen in 6 weeks, we will have the best quality control in the industry. This is completely voluntary. We're under no regulator compulsion to do this. We've simply decided that at our company, good enough is no longer good enough. We insist on being best. Now, everything in that statement is technically accurate. Okay? That's what I meant when I said it takes nine drafts to mislead without lying. Everything in that statement, you know, the lawyer signed off on it is true, the PR people signed off on it is appropriately misleading. But what do you think the effect of that statement was on the regulator with whom they negotiated the consent decree? What's a one-word description for her reaction? It's the word of the day. Outrage. She was outraged. Okay. This was her achievement. She was very proud of it. She doubtless wrote home to her parents, guess what I did today. She felt very good about pushing this company in the direction of better quality control, and they were publicly stealing the credit that she felt that she deserved. So she got even. Okay, and she got even in a fairly clever way, I think. She dragged her heels on the reinspection. Then she dragged her heels on the paperwork. When she finally issued the paperwork, she had found a few small new quality control problems necessitating another round of reinspection. First re-engineering, then reinspection, then paperwork. She turned a six-week shutdown into a nine-month shutdown. The company ran out of pacemakers and went into bankruptcy. She put them out of business. Now, her psychology is interesting, but But I think the company psychology is more interesting. I mean, here's a fairly underpaid young regulator who has your entire corporate future in her hands. And if you're thinking straight at all, you would be making her self-esteem your highest priority. And instead, they were riding roughshod over her self-esteem and nurturing their own self-esteem. Okay, everybody see what I'm talking about? Okay, they were making a higher priority on management feeling good than on this regulator feeling good. Now, when I was a hippie in the 60s, I had hair. I thought the main thing wrong with corporate capitalism was excessive preoccupation with profit. I now, 40 years later, think the main thing wrong with corporate capitalism is insufficient preoccupation with profit. Faced with a choice between two management strategies, one of which maximizes profit at the expense of the comfort and ego and outrage of managers, and the other of which gives them a chance to feel comfortable, gives them a chance to feel high self-esteem, and gives them a chance to get even with their enemy at the expense of profit. Most managers at every level, most CEOs all the way down to very junior executives, choose to nurture their own self-esteem, nurture their own outrage, nurture their own comfort, instead of nurturing the profit of the company. And I think, the story I just told about this company that manufactured pacemakers is a very good illustration of that. But if we had more time, I could give you 50 illustrations of that. It's extraordinary to me how often companies piss away millions of dollars in shareholder value in order to nurture their own self-esteem and comfort and their own outrage at the people they're angry at. Okay. So let me just summarize number four. You have a total of four reasons for giving away the credit. The first is it's true. The second is it makes the behavior credible. The third is it nurtures capitalism. And the fourth is it keeps your stakeholders, the people who made you do it, who are in fact your stakeholders, but particularly the efficacious, powerful stakeholders, it keeps their outrage from escalating in totally unnecessary ways. Any questions about number four?
Do you think the same give out people has the same, you have the same view? So we're driven by regulators to make sure we have a license to operate, whether it be environmental or financial. But do you think it's true for the safety of our people? So the businesses put profits ahead of the safety of their people, or do they consciously go out and forsake profit in lieu of people's safety, making sure they go home to the family. I mean,
the relationship between safety and profitability, I think is fairly complicated. I mean, obviously, you do reach the point where safety and profitability diverge, where you can only achieve higher safety at the expense of profitability. But earlier on in that curve, safety and profitability are linked because, your failure to work safe is costing you a lot of money. It's costing you regulatory money. It's costing you, training money and retraining money. It's costing you workers' comp money as you have to, compensate the, victims and families of victims of people who have been hurt. It's costing you reputational money. So, I mean, eventually, every company, if it gets good enough, gets to the point where further safety is at the expense of profit. But most companies aren't there yet. They are, most of them, at the point where profitability and safety are hand in hand. And then when they go to their employees and say, it's not now we love fish more than profit, it's we love you more than profit. A message like, safety is our number one priority. I worked years ago with Western Mining of sainted fame when they were having trouble with safety. I mean, they had a safety problem. They brought me in because their safety record was, in their own judgment, inadequate. And they said, our employees are not following our safety instructions. They're not working as safe as we want them to, and it's costing us a lot of money. And I looked around, and their key message was safety is our number one priority. And I talked to some employees, and I said, well, what do you think of that? And they said, well, we know that's not true. You know, we know their number one priority is profitability. So when they say safety is their number one priority, we know that's a lie. And it turns out employees were drawing from the truth that safety wasn't the company's number one priority, that false conclusion that it wasn't a high priority at all. And employees were convinced that the company didn't care about safety. So employees were, in a pretty loyal way, working safe only when the safety people were on the floor. And when the safety people weren't around, employees were cutting corners, not because they were challenging what the company wanted, but because they thought that was what the company wanted. Okay. And you know, what I recommended is that if they concede that safety is one among several priorities and that profitability is also a very high priority and productivity is also a very high priority and they are in lockstep right now, we are hemorrhaging money because our safety record stinks, okay, that message would be much more credible to employees than safety is our number one priority. Now, I understand that the mining industry is pretty genuine about safety. If you to generalize about the distinctions between the mining industry and the oil industry, the mining industry really means it about safety and fakes it about environment. The oil industry really means it about environment and fakes it about safety. I mean, that's a gross oversimplification, but you know, in safety is deep in your culture in ways that it isn't in most other companies. Nonetheless, I would bet as an empirical proposition that your employees are going to find safety messages more credible and more effective if you link them to profit than if you link them to saintliness. Okay. So in that sense, the short answer is yes, it's the same. Other comments on number five? Number four.
Is there a case that it's best not to discuss achievements if you are driven by your stakeholders? Regulators that let them have that particular win, and that gives confidence to others in the community that you've got a fairly controlling regulator. Is there a case that discussing achievements isn't really necessary or even productive?
Well, I mean, the most credible people about your achievements are the people who made you do it. You know, so I mean, if you can get an activist group to say, God knows what Rio Tinto would have done if we hadn't been on the scene. But we were there, and they wanted to do X, and we said absolutely not. And they wanted to do Y, and we said absolutely not. And then they proposed Z, and Z's not so bad. And we let them do Z, so now they're doing Z, and it's okay thanks to us. That's terrific. I mean, assuming Z is something you guys can live with, to have an activist group taking credit for making you do Z is ideal. But I have no problem with you giving them credit for doing Z, especially if they're reluctant to take the credit. Because they are sometimes reluctant to take the credit. They're a little, you know this, but let me say it, especially since we're probably not going to get to the session on activist groups. Activist groups are invariably torn between their left wing and their right wing. Their left wing, which includes most of their volunteers, okay, wants them to be more extremist, more purist, and gets angry at them if they start to look co-opted. Their right wing, which is most of their contributors, wants them to be more compromising, more willing to win half a loaf rather than stay pure, and gets angry at them if they become too purist. And they're endlessly zigging and zagging between those two stakeholders that they have. Okay, so sometimes they don't want to claim credit. And you have to sort of give them credit, knowing that it will be hard for them to disavow the credit. If this is interesting to you, let me give you a concrete example of exactly that situation. This was a fight between Greenpeace and Dow Chemical. And Greenpeace, as part of its anti-dioxin campaign, decided to dramatize Dow's connection to dioxin, and it sent a whole bunch of campaigners to Midland, Michigan, the international headquarters of Dow, and their job was to attack Dow every time they could and try and brand dioxin a Dow brand. Dow knew they were coming. You know, it was in the Greenpeace newsletter, which Dow rationally reads. So it knew they were coming. And as Dow planned what it would say in response to the Greenpeace campaign, they were planning to say something like this. Look, Dow was going to say, Greenpeace wants zero dioxin. They want zero chlorine. They want chlorine out of the periodic table. That's irrational. It's Luddite. It's unscientific. It's irresponsible. Nobody knows that better than us. We're Dow, and we have already spent hundreds of millions of dollars reducing our dioxin emissions by 90%. So on the one hand, you've got Greenpeace irrationally demanding the impossible, and on the other hand, you have Dow conscientiously and responsibly solving the dioxin problem. Okay. Very traditional industry rhetoric. By the time Greenpeace got to Midland, here's what Dow wound up saying instead. And I hope you can hear the difference between the two speeches. Here's what Dow ended up saying. Look, they said, Greenpeace wants zero dioxin. They want zero chlorine. That's impossible. They know that. They're not stupid. They also know that they will get closer to it if they demand it than if they have some more moderate demand. Nobody knows that better than us. We are Dow, and we have already spent hundreds of millions of dollars reducing our dioxin emissions by 90%. We know for sure that the main reason we have done that is Greenpeace. Now, Greenpeace is not satisfied with 90%. They want 100%. They're not going to get 100%. They know that. We know they know that. They know we know they know that. Okay. There are no surprises here. Greenpeace isn't going to have to settle for 90%. By the time this fight is over, they'll get somewhere between 93 and 95% dioxin emission reductions out of us. They've got 90% already. They're going to get another 3 to 5%, and then that'll be as far as they can push us. We're now fighting over the difference between 93% dioxin reduction and 95% dioxin reduction. As you watch the end game, don't neglect to notice, ladies and gentlemen, they've already won 90% of what they want. They're going to get another 3 to 5%, and then it'll be over. You hear the difference between those two speeches? Okay. Now, if you're Greenpeace, you're kind of between a rock and a hard place. I mean, if Dow is saying, you know, you forced them to reduce their emissions by 90%, what are you going to say? No, we didn't. Okay. But you're not happy if you're Greenpeace because this undermines your campaign. I mean, you know, who wants to contribute to table scraps? You know, if Greenpeace has already won 90% of the fight, who's going to go to a meeting about the last 3 to 5%? Who's going to make a contribution to the last 3 to 5%? Who wants to read or write a news story about the last 3 to 5%? So the bottom fell out of the campaign. They weren't getting any coverage. They weren't getting any new members. They weren't getting any money. Greenpeace, like any well-run organization, tracks the profitability of its product line, and the Dow campaign stopped making money. So Greenpeace abandoned the campaign. They're not stupid. You know, they had rented their office in Midland, Michigan for I don't know how many years. But after 18 months or so, on the strength of Dow's giving Greenpeace credit, Greenpeace quit. They sublet the office and reassigned those campaigners to a different issue in a different place. And they were out of Dow's hair, not permanently. You know, they came back in another decade on a different issue. But for the moment, they were out of Dow's hair. Who won the fight? They both did. I mean, Greenpeace on its way out the door certainly claimed victory. I mean, you know, Greenpeace said, this is an example of how powerful we are. Even Dow admits we forced them to reduce their emissions by 90%. Even Dow has promised another 3 to 5%. You know, our work here is done. And off they went. I mean, you know, because they know how to lose claiming victory. And, you know, it wasn't a huge defeat for Greenpeace, but it was certainly a success for Dow. Okay. So, I mean, do you see how that's a response to the issue?
Sometimes in corporate land, we get sucked into getting stressed about the 3 to 5% that we're going to lose when... It's in the overall scheme of things, it's not that much, but it certainly could go some way to
I guess, placating those that are against us, or making them feel comfortable that we've made some effort or something along those lines?
Yeah. I mean, look, I am not an expert on when you should stonewall and when you should make concessions, you know, because that's a substantive question. How much is the next 3% going to cost you? Technically. Not my field. I haven't a clue. Okay. Where I have expertise is here. If you decide to make concessions, don't make them secretly. Okay. Now, I mean, if you're going to stonewall, fine, stonewall. You know better than I do whether that 3% is going to bankrupt your company or is going to make a huge difference to your bottom line. I don't have any expertise there. But what you shouldn't ever do, and companies do all the time, is make concessions and then pretend they didn't. You know, make concessions and give the credit to themselves, saying we did it because we wanted to. That's really stupid. It pisses off the people you're making the concessions to. It undermines the credibility of the concessions. It has all the disadvantages I've been talking about. You know, do what you think is best for your company, but if what's best for your company is to make a concession, get the value of the concession. Make sure we know it's a concession. Everybody's vision of reality, in my judgment, everybody's vision of reality is, you know, the NGOs are terriers nipping at your heels. And we're glad they are nipping at your heels because we fervently believe that if you were allowed to do what you want without anybody nipping at your heels, what you would choose to do would be horrible for the society. So we want there to be critics who attack you. But we don't want the critics to win the war. We want them to win a few battles and then lose the war because we kind of know the terriers are not good at running the world. Okay, so we want them to nip at your heels, and we want them to force you to change your behavior, and then at some point we get something between bored. You know, remember I said outrage management is a lot about boring people. We get something between bored and satisfied. Now the terriers don't, the activists don't. They'll nip at your heels forever if they can, if it pays off for their organization. They're never satisfied, and apparently they're never bored. But the rest of us want to see the activists win some battles, and then we want to see you allowed to go on with business. Okay. If you buy that's how we see the world, and I would argue that that's how everybody sees the world, then there are two corollaries. The first corollary is whatever concessions you're going to make them early. Okay. Don't stonewall for a year and then make concessions because you just wasted a year. You know, make them early. And the second corollary is make them visibly concessions. Make it clear that this is something Greenpeace won from you, or this is something the TOs won from you, or this is something, you know, whoever it is won from you, so that the rest of us get it that they won that battle. Don't lose secret battles. Because you have to lose a few before you're allowed to win the war.